households, and it's very important that we take consideration of gender aspects as we do marine spatial planning and as we plan for ocean spaces for the blue economy.
That was Dr. Jacqueline Uku, a marine scientist at the Kenya Marine and Fisheries Institute in Mombasa. And I am Diana Wanyonyi, reporting for Wings in Kwale County on the Kenyan coast.
Wings thanks all our supporters, including your local community radio stations, Suzette Cullen, and Genevieve Vaughn, whose works can be found on the website gifteconomy.com. That's gift-economy.com. The Wings sound logo is from Lee Bonner's album A Circle Is Cast. I'm Wings series producer Frieda Worden. This is the Women's International News Gathering Service.
You're listening to KBOO Portland at 90.7 FM.
Goodbye.
KBOO Community Radio is conducting a survey. Help us shape the types of news, public affairs, and music programming KBOO broadcasts in the future. Tell us how you listen to KBOO, and we'll use this feedback to help serve you better. The survey is anonymous. However, you will have an opportunity to provide your contact information to enter a drawing. 10 lucky winners will receive a $50 gift card. Complete the community survey before Sunday, July 16th. Go to our website at kboo.fm/survey23. That's kboo.fm/survey23. Thank you in advance for your time and your feedback. Stay tuned for KBOO's next strategic plan coming soon.
Can't get good reception of KBOO on your radio? Just type in www.kboo.fm on your PC or laptop and click on Listen Live. We're just a mouse click away.
This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
AI has just hacked the operating system of human civilization. The operating system of every human culture in history has always been language. In the beginning was the word. We use language to create mythology and laws, to create gods and money, to create art and science, to create friendships and nations. What we are potentially talking about is nothing less than the end of human history. Now, not the end of history, just the end of the human-dominated part of what we call history. History is the interaction between biology and culture. It's the interaction between our biological needs and desires for things like food and sex, and our cultural creations like religions and laws. History is the process through which religions and laws interact with food and sex. Now, what will happen to the course of this interaction of history when AI takes over culture? Within a few years, AI could eat the whole of human culture, everything that was produced for thousands and thousands of years, to eat all of it, digest it, and start gushing out a flood of new cultural creations, new cultural artifacts.
That was Israeli scholar Yuval Noah Harari speaking April 29, 2023 in Switzerland for the Future of Life Institute.
Mitigating the risk of extinction from AI should be a global priority alongside other societal scale risks such as pandemics and nuclear war.
In May 2023, that one sentence warning came from over 350 tech leaders and researchers. The technology they were developing, they said, could enslave or wipe out humanity. Among the signatories, Sam Altman, the CEO of OpenAI, Demis Hassabis, CEO of Google DeepMind, Dario Amodei, CEO of Anthropic, and Geoffrey Hinton, the so-called godfather of AI, who recently quit Google over fears about his own life's work. Some experts like the Egyptian Mo Gawdat and Geoffrey Hinton say the immediate threat of AI is much greater as a danger than climate change. We hear more about why in today's show. For clarity, I focus on one speaker, that Israeli public intellectual, professor, and historian Yuval Noah Harari. He is author of 10 books. Sparking these urgent warnings on March 22nd, a group of AI experts and researchers called for a pause to AI experiments until some kind of regulation made them safer. This was published by the Future of Life Institute. One of the signatories was Yuval Noah Harari. You're going to hear selections from two different venues. We begin with Yuval Harari at the Frontiers Forum, filmed in April 2023 in Montreux, Switzerland. Then we go to an in-depth chat hosted by popular podcaster Jordan Harbinger and heard by at least 10 million listeners via Apple Podcasts, YouTube, and his website. Harbinger gets what others miss. So here we go with a few short clips from Yuval Noah Harari, April 2023, presented by the Future of Life Institute.
Wonderful introduction. And yes, what I want to talk to you about is AI and the future of humanity. Now, I know that these conferences focus on the ecological crisis facing humanity, but for better or for worse, AI too is part of this crisis. AI can help us in many ways to overcome the ecological crisis, or it can make it far, far worse. Actually, AI will probably change the very meaning of the ecological system, because for 4 billion years, the ecological system of planet Earth contained only organic life forms. And now, or soon, we might see the emergence of the first inorganic life forms after 4 billion years, or at the very least, the emergence of inorganic agents. Now, people have feared AI since the very beginning of the computer age in the middle of the 20th century. And this fear has inspired many science fiction classics like The Terminator or The Matrix. Now, while such science fiction scenarios have become cultural landmarks, they haven't usually been taken seriously in academic and scientific and political debates, and perhaps for a good reason. Because science fiction scenarios usually assume that before AI can pose a significant threat to humanity, it will have to reach or to pass two important milestones. First, AI will have to become sentient and develop consciousness, feelings, emotions. Otherwise, why would it even want to take over the world? Secondly, AI will have to become adept at navigating the physical world. Robots will have to be able to move around and operate in houses and cities and mountains and forests, at least as dexterously and efficiently as humans. If they cannot move around the physical world, how can they possibly take it over? And as of April 2023, AI still seems far from reaching either of these milestones. Despite all the hype around ChatGPT and the other new AI tools, there is no evidence that these tools have even a shred of consciousness, of feelings, of emotions. As for navigating the physical world, despite the hype around self-driving vehicles, the date at which these vehicles will dominate our roads keeps being postponed. However, the bad news is that to threaten the survival of human civilization, AI doesn't really need consciousness, and it doesn't need the ability to move around the physical world. Over the last few years, new AI tools have been unleashed into the public sphere, which may threaten the survival of human civilization from a very unexpected direction. And it's difficult for us to even grasp the capabilities of these new AI tools and the speed at which they continue to develop. Indeed, because AI is able to learn by itself, to improve itself, even the developers of these tools don't know the full capabilities of what they have created, and they are themselves often surprised by emergent abilities and emergent qualities of these tools. I guess everybody here is already aware of some of the most fundamental abilities of the new AI tools. Abilities like writing text, drawing images, composing music, and writing code. But there are many additional capabilities that are emerging, like deep faking people's voices and images, like drafting bills, finding weaknesses both in computer code and also in legal contracts and in legal agreements. But perhaps most importantly, the new AI tools are gaining the ability to develop deep and intimate relationships with human beings. Each of these abilities deserves an entire discussion, and it is difficult for us to understand their full implications. So let's make it simple. When we take all of these abilities together as a package, they boil down to one very, very big thing: the ability to manipulate and to generate language, whether with words or images or sounds. The most important aspect of the current phase of the ongoing AI revolution is that AI is gaining mastery of language at a level that surpasses the average human ability. And by gaining mastery of language, AI is seizing the master key, unlocking the doors of all our institutions, from banks to temples. Because language is the tool that we use to give instructions to our bank and also to inspire heavenly visions in our minds. Another way to think of it is that AI has just hacked the operating system of human civilization. The operating system of every human culture in history has always been language. In the beginning was the word. We use language to create mythology and laws, to create gods and money, to create art and science, to create friendships and nations. Now, what would it mean for human beings to live in a world where perhaps most of the stories, melodies, images, laws, policies, and tools are shaped by a non-human, alien intelligence which knows how to exploit with superhuman efficiency the weaknesses, biases, and addictions of the human mind, and also knows how to form deep and even intimate relationships with human beings? That's the big question. Already today, in games like chess, no human can hope to beat a computer. What if the same thing happens in art, in politics, economics, and even in religion? When people think about ChatGPT and the other new AI tools, they are often drawn to examples like kids using ChatGPT to write their school essays. What will happen to the school system when kids write essays with ChatGPT? Horrible. But this kind of question misses the big picture. Forget about the school essays. Instead, think, for example, about the next US presidential race in 2024 and try to imagine the impact of the new AI tools that can mass produce political manifestos, fake news stories, and even holy scriptures for new cults. In recent years, the politically influential QAnon cult has formed around anonymous online texts known as Q-drops. Now, followers of this cult, which are millions now in the US and the rest of the world, collected, revered, and interpreted these Q-drops as some kind of new scriptures, as a sacred text. Now, to the best of our knowledge, all previous Q-drops were composed by human beings, and bots only helped to disseminate these texts online. But in future, we might see the first cults and religions in history whose revered texts were written by a non-human intelligence. And of course, religions throughout history claimed that their holy books were written by a non-human intelligence. This was never true before. This could become true very, very quickly, with far-reaching consequences. Now, on a more prosaic level, we might soon find ourselves conducting lengthy online discussions about abortion, or about climate change, or about the Russian invasion of Ukraine, with entities that we think are fellow human beings, but are actually AI bots. Now, the catch is that it's utterly useless, it's pointless for us to waste our time trying to convince an AI bot to change its political views. But the longer we spend talking with the bot, the better it gets to know us and understand how to hone its messages in order to shift our political views or our economic views or anything else. Through its mastery of language, AI, as I said, could also form intimate relationships with people and use the power of intimacy to influence our opinions and worldview. Now, there is no indication that AI has, as I said, any consciousness, any feelings of its own, but in order to create fake intimacy with human beings, AI doesn't need feelings of its own. It only needs to be able to inspire feelings in us, to get us to be attached to it. Now, in June 2022, there was a famous incident when the Google engineer Blake Lemoine publicly claimed that the AI chatbot Lambda, on which he was working, has become sentient. This very controversial claim cost him his job. He was fired. Now, the most interesting thing about this episode wasn't Lemoine's claim, which was most probably false. The really interesting thing was his willingness to risk and ultimately lose his very lucrative job for the sake of the AI chatbot that he thought he was protecting. If AI can influence people to risk and lose their jobs, what else can it induce us to do?
Those were selected clips from a 41-minute presentation by professor and author Yuval Noah Harari. Thanks to the Future of Life Institute for posting this speech on YouTube. Find links to all that in my show blog at ecoshock.org.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
Next up, Jordan Harbinger interviewed Yuval Harari in a conversation that was over 1 hour long. It was released June 20th, 2023, to over 10 million podcast subscribers and posted on YouTube. It is a wide-ranging discussion going from blockchain to the Ukraine war, but I selected parts of it with a focus on artificial life versus human life. What could go right and what could go horribly wrong? Why the urgency? This is Jordan Harbinger with Dr. Harari.
I've heard you say that the idea that knowledge is power is somewhat obsolete now because information is unlimited. Tell me about that, because it does seem like this landscape has maybe changed a little bit from 1,000 years ago, where information was rare.
Yeah, I mean, for most of history, information was rare. I mean, the main job of the education system was just to provide people with, you know, the basics, with the basic information about the world. And censorship worked by blocking information. Now it's the other way around.
We are flooded by enormous amounts of information that we cannot handle. The main job of the education system is not to provide information. We don't need more information. We need the ability to sift through the information, to tell the difference between reliable and unreliable information. This is what we need from education. And censorship also, it works by flooding us with even more information so we don't know what to pay attention to. And basically, it's a bit like what happens with food. We really need to go on an information diet. For most of history, food was scarce, so you ate whatever you got. Now, even poor people in many countries, they actually suffer from too much food. And what you need is to be very careful about which kind of food you put into your body. It's the same with information. We need an information diet to be very, very careful what kinds of information we are feeding our minds, because very often we feed our minds junk food.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. I mean, we have misinformation, which is sort of maybe accidentally bad information, but we also have disinformation. And like you said, censorship, which is sort of the other side of that coin, where it seems like you can talk to people. It's almost like the more information we consume now, the more misinformed somebody is. My dad, who reads news all day, and my mom, they're lovely people, but they'll tell me something and I'm like, wait a minute, that is just a wildly untrue thing that you are parroting. Where did you read that? Oh, it's all over the news. Well, there's your problem right there.
Yeah, one very, very basic misconception is that people tend to equate information with truth, and information isn't truth. Lies are also information. Fictions and fantasies are also information. Most information in the world is not about the truth. It's not about anything. It doesn't represent anything. It builds new things. So, you know, even if you think in terms of in biological terms, even if you think about the most basic type of information on the planet for living organisms, which is DNA, DNA doesn't represent anything. DNA builds new things. If you read our DNA code or the DNA code of anything, of a virus, of a zebra, you don't find there representations of the world, like representations of lions and giraffes and whatever. And also not representation of our own body, like the heart or the kidneys or anything like that. Mm-hmm. What you find are instructions to build things. And it's the same with most of the information that people exchange between themselves. Most of the information, not just today, but throughout history, didn't represent anything. So you can't really ask, is it true or not? It was building blocks to create religions and economic systems and things like that. If you think about money, for instance, money is basically a fictional story that we create by exchanging information between us. It doesn't represent anything real in the outside world. Most of the dollars in the world, you know, they are just not even pieces of paper. They are just electronic information passing between computers. And we are willing to work hard for an entire month just to get these little bits of information moved from one computer to another computer, because we believe the stories that the greatest storytellers in the world, the bankers and finance ministers and financial gurus, tell us. Most of the time, what information is doing is not telling us the truth about the world. It's creating new things in the world.
When you were talking with my friend Rich Roll, this is years ago, by the way, so I'm going to give you some freedom to change your opinion if you want to.
Okay.
You mentioned something that was akin to human feelings, human desires, and human thinking. Those are sort of the ultimate arbiter of choice. And yeah. I think you call it, it's something along the lines of humanism. Maybe there's a better way to explain it than the way I just butchered it. But maybe we should start with what humanism is, because now that we have artificial intelligence and machine learning and social media algorithms, do these technologies threaten the idea that people are actually choosing anything?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, humanism is the idea that, as you said, the ultimate arbiter, the ultimate judge in almost all fields of life are human feelings and human desires. For instance, in politics, the government is not chosen by God. It's not inherited within a dynasty, a family. But we have elections in which humans choose according to their feelings and desires. Similarly, in the economic field, the humanist principle is that the customer is always right. That people go to the supermarket or to the market and they buy stuff according to their own feelings, what they want. This is the humanist approach to economics, in contrast to a totalitarian approach, like in communism, that you have a government telling you what you need to have or what you're allowed to buy. Similarly, in the field of art, humanism, the principle of humanism there is beauty is in the eyes of the beholder. What is beautiful, artistically, is determined by our feelings. There is no outside authority that can decide for us what is beautiful, what is good art, what TV we should watch or whatever. And finally, if you look at the field of morality, of ethics, so throughout history, you had many ethical systems that claimed that it was some force outside humanity that tells us what is good, what is right, how we should behave. And the humanist idea is that no, the ultimate judge, even in the field of ethics, is human feelings. That it's not, it doesn't mean simplistically it's just do whatever you want. It means that the way to judge whether an action is good or evil is its impact on the feelings of human beings and maybe other sentient beings. If something causes harm, which means it causes suffering, it causes pain, it causes sadness, this is bad. If mm-hmm. something does not cause harm, then it's okay. So if you take something like, you know, homosexuality, so you had for centuries people saying that this is a sin. Why? Because the Bible forbids it, or because God forbids it. And then you had humanists coming and asking, well, it doesn't matter what some book says. We want to know who is harmed by it. If two men love each other and they feel good about it and their love doesn't harm anybody, why should this be a sin? And from this perspective, humanism comes and says, no, it's not a sin. It's perfectly okay. The yardstick is always human feelings. Of course, there are complicated cases. What happens if, I don't know, I steal your car and I feel good about it and you feel bad about it? So we need to weigh different feelings one against the other. And so you have a lot of complicated ethical debates in humanism, but the arguments on both sides are always in terms of human feelings, not in terms of some outside force like a god that comes and tells you, irrespective of human feelings, what is good and what is bad. So this is kind of humanism in very briefly. And now all this is put into question, to some extent at least, by the rise of artificial intelligence that is increasingly deciphering us and also makes decisions about us on the basis of a completely different logic. You know, previously in history, all the tools we invented always empowered us, because no tool was capable of making decisions independently. If you invent a stone knife, so you can use the knife to murder somebody, you can use the knife to cut salad, you can use the knife to save somebody in surgery, but this is your decision. The knife cannot decide what to do with it. And it's the same with an atom bomb. An atom bomb, or nuclear energy, let's say more broadly,
sure.
Nuclear energy can be used to produce electricity cheaply, which is good. It can be used to destroy human civilization, to bomb cities and countries. But the decision is not in the hands of a bomb. A nuclear bomb cannot make decisions. It's always a human being deciding to push the button or not. Now, AI is different. It's the first technology ever that we invented that can actually make decisions by itself. And therefore, it takes power away from us. And it is increasingly making more and more decisions about our lives. whether to give us a loan, whether to accept us to a job or to university, even sentences in court are increasingly influenced or even given by AI. The thing is, we increasingly don't even understand how the AI reaches its decisions. One of the biggest problems in the field of AI, many people are working on it, so maybe we'll solve it at some point, but at present it's still a very huge problem, is explainability. That the AI, let's say you apply to a bank to get a loan, the bank says no, and you ask why not, and the bank says, we don't know. The AI, the algorithm said no. And people are working on explainability, on being able to explain why the AI said no, but there are some very, very difficult problems. It might ultimately be impossible to explain to humans the decisions of AI, because we think in one way and AI makes decisions in a completely different way than human beings, that we might just not be able to grasp it.
I think that's likely true. I mean, think about asking a human to explain why they made a decision. You're not going to get the right. You're not going to get the truth. Why didn't you like her, that girl you went out with on a date? I don't know. She was just a little bit. I can't put my finger on it. Or you might say, you know what? I just wasn't attracted to her. She's very sweet, but that's it. But then if you were to deconstruct the whole evening and every message we'd sent, well, probably through AI, it would be like, when she did this, it signaled this, and then your brain subconsciously thought these other things, and then it reminded you of your aunt who you don't like, and therefore you don't want to see her again. But you'll never come up with that answer consciously.
Yes.
You would never do it yourself in a million years.
Absolutely. Again, it's so difficult for us to understand how our own brain works and makes decisions. It's even more difficult when it comes to a non-human type of intelligence.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
Back to the Jordan Harbinger Show.
So these systems not only know what we want, essentially more than we know what we want, at least consciously, but they can go further, right? They can program us to want things. And social media, as rudimentary as that AI is now, it seems like they're kind of on the way to designing our thoughts and desires in a way that will eventually supersede us as decision makers entirely.
Yeah, you know, in social media, we had very, very primitive AI. Because in social media, all the content that we consumed, all the videos and texts and whatever, it was produced by human beings. The only thing the AI did, the algorithms in social media did, was to curate the content, to decide which video to show which person when. And even though it's a very primitive thing, it still had such an immense impact on our society and politics. And at least to some extent, it is behind a lot of the political crisis we now see in the world. Because the algorithms in many of the platforms, Facebook, TikTok, whatever, were given quite a simple job. Nobody told the algorithms, at least in most cases, create political polarization. They were simply given the task of maximizing the time people spend on the platform. It was a battle for attention, how to keep people on our platform for 50 minutes a day instead of 40 minutes a day. And the algorithms, by trial and error, they discovered that if they show people content that, for instance, makes them angry or hateful or fearful, this tends to hook their attention and keep them on the platform. So inadvertently, the AI was influencing not just the opinions of individuals, but the entire atmosphere in society. Like feeding millions of people with a lot of hatred and anger and fear every day. And we now see the consequences. The new generation of AI can go much, much further than these primitive social media algorithms, because they can actually create the content. And they cannot just create the content, create fake news stories, create conspiracy theories, create fake videos You can take any politician or you and me and now make us do and say almost anything you want. You can create a deep fake. What is even worse in many ways is that because of its new linguistic abilities, the new generation of AI, like ChatGPT and GPT-4, they can create intimate relationships with human beings. They don't have consciousness of their own. They don't have feelings and emotions of their own. They don't feel anything. But through their mastery of language, they can make us connect to them, feel attached to them. And we can now have the tool to mass produce intimate relationships. And in the field of persuasion, if you want to change somebody's political opinions, if you want to change to make them buy some product, the most powerful weapon in the arsenal, the atom bomb, is intimate relationships. You know, if you read something in a newspaper, that may not change your mind. But if you have an intimate relationship with somebody and they say something, or over many days and weeks, they kind of drip a certain message, this is extremely powerful. And now AI can do that. It can create, like, you're maybe interacting with somebody online that you think is a real human being. You're having a conversation with them about all kinds of things. Maybe you even talk over Zoom. You see them on video and you think it's a real human being and you become attached to them and you care about them. But it's actually an AI.
Are you dropping a hint right now?
Is this
a real conversation? Are you really there? Are you watching Succession?
That's,
and I'm talking to your representation.
That's the question that we'll increasingly be asking. Is it really a human being? Now, you know, 2-3 years ago, it was very easy to tell that if you read a text, it's obvious to you if this text was written by a human being or by a computer, because there was a certain level of sophistication and coherence that machines were simply incapable of. Today, I think everybody had the experience in the last few weeks or last 2 or 3 months to read a text by, say, ChatGPT and say, this is it. I'm no longer capable of being sure whether texts are generated by a human or by an AI. Today, I think there was this big headline about a prize in photography given to an image which people thought was taken by a human being, but it was actually generated by an AI.
Ooh, wow.
And this will increasingly happen with conversations. You know, it's one thing to create a text. It's another thing to have an ongoing interactive conversation. Add to that video and sound, how to mimic the body language, the facial expressions, the tone of voice. This is even more complicated, but we are getting there. So we are very close to the point when you're now having this conversation with me and you cannot be absolutely sure that you're not actually talking with an AI. Previously in history, if you wanted to do a propaganda campaign or an influence campaign and talk with people, so you had, like, before elections, you would send volunteers to knock on doors and try to have conversations with people. It was so expensive because you need so many volunteers. And it's inefficient because you have a conversation of, say, 5 minutes, 10 minutes. It's not an intimate relationship. But think about the possibility that with the new technology, you can mass produce intimate relationships with millions of people, like you had these bot farms, bot armies. So now the bot armies can also mass produce intimacy. We've never seen anything like it in history. And it's especially dangerous for democracies because democracy in the end is a conversation. That's what it is. It's lots of people having a conversation about, you know, the big issues of the day, how to deal with climate change, what to do about abortion, what to do about gun control. So we have a conversation. Once AI hacks human language, it can basically break down the conversation. What happens if you spend hours talking with somebody you think is a human being, but it's actually an AI? The conversation breaks down. Now, for autocratic regimes, This is good news.
Mm-hmm.
But for democracies, this is an existential danger.
This is like the political version of that Joaquin Phoenix movie, Her, where I think Scarlett Johansson is an AI and he falls in love with her and she's like, I think towards the end, spoiler alert here, he says, how many people are you talking to? And she's like, 14,500,783. Yeah. And he's like, oh, and it just breaks him, right? Because
yes.
He realizes that he's just like a not even a number on a spreadsheet at that point. Hey, if you like what you're hearing and seeing, check out the Jordan Harbinger Show podcast feed. There's a lot more just like this. You can find the Jordan Harbinger Show in Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. Now, back to the show. What other new technology trends worry you? Maybe what like genetic engineering, for example?
It is worrying, but it's developing on a much, much slower time scale, slower pace. Because anything that has to do with biology, it moves far more slowly.
Sure.
Like if you now make a change to human DNA and you want to see the result, it takes years. Because, you know, giving birth to a baby and then they have to grow up, and it takes decades for just one iteration of trying to change people through genetic engineering. Anything that has to do with the world of information and culture, it's far, far faster. So I do think that biotechnology also has a lot of both positive and negative potential to completely change history. But I'm not sure if we have the time. When AI is going to completely change the course of history within the next, I don't know, 10 years. Genetic engineering, it will take decades or even centuries. So we probably just don't have the time.
Right. It's like the least of our concerns is something that's going to happen in 200 years if we, in the next 20 years, are going to have a completely different artificial intelligence landscape.
One danger that we should take into consideration is, of course, genetic engineering, not of humans, but, you know, viruses or pathogens or
sure.
things like that, that today you can basically print, you can just write code. And even AI can write a code for a new virus, print it out, and you have a new epidemic. So these are things that we should be concerned about. But with regard to changing humanity itself, I think that information technology is just moving much, much faster than biotechnology.
You said something on 60 Minutes that really freaked out our boy Anderson Cooper. Something along the lines of, within a century or two, the Earth will be populated by beings as different from us as we are from chimpanzees. And that's a hell of an assertion, Yuval.
Yeah.
What do you mean by that? What's happening with society in 200 years?
Yeah, well, again, it's more about technology than about society. The combination of biotechnology on one side and artificial intelligence on the other side means that if we don't destroy ourselves in the next century or two, we are very, very likely to use these technologies to either change ourselves, our own bodies and brains and minds, to such an extent that, again, we are more different, or these future entities will be more different from us than we are different from Neanderthals. You know, the only difference between us and Neanderthals is just a few genetic mutations, which led to changes in brain structure and a hormonal system and so forth. So we now acquire the technology, maybe not in the next 10 years, but in the next 100 years, of making even bigger changes intentionally to our DNA, to our bodies, to our brains. And in addition, we have the breakthrough in AI, which could lead either to combinations of organic bodies with computers, which are known as cyborgs, or to the creation of completely inorganic entities, completely inorganic beings that could be far more intelligent and capable than us. And, you know, it's difficult even to imagine what these beings would be like, because our own imagination is the product of organic biochemistry. It's the product of our own organic brain. And it's very difficult for us to even imagine what an inorganic entity, an inorganic being, would look like or would be capable of doing. You know, as organic creatures, for instance, we are used to the situation that you are always in one place in space. And all the parts of your body must be connected together for you to be alive. So I'm now in Tel Aviv. I can't be at the same time in Chicago or in Sydney. Mm-hmm. But this is just organic beings. If you're talking about an inorganic entity or a cyborg, these limitations collapse. An algorithm or an AI entity, it can be in many places at the same time. And a cyborg could also be spread over space. So if your brain, and this is experiments that has already been done, you can today connect a bionic hand to a brain of a human, and you control the hand with just your brain. But the hand doesn't need to be attached to your body. You can control the hand by remote control, even if it's in another room or another city or another continent. So even these very fundamental things, like being in one place at one time, which we think this is obvious, all life forms obey these laws, this may not apply to the future entities, which might control the planet in a century or two.
And it makes sense for humans to build this kind of thing, because I'm thinking of a medical application, right? If I have brain cancer, God forbid, right? Knock on wood. And the best surgeon for that is in Israel. And maybe I can't travel. Maybe I just don't even need to. I go to the hospital in New York or somewhere in LA, and the guy in Israel cracks his knuckles before planning to go to watch the next Succession season 500 episode. And he just gives me the brain surgery from whatever tech deck he's using, and doesn't even need to wash his hands because he's, you know, whatever. He's touching the same gloves he uses every day. Yeah. I get life-saving surgery, and he, at the end, you know, goes and gets a massage and watches some TV or whatever the equivalent is in 50 or 100 years. And it's just routine. And I just got the best surgery of my life from a human. Or if maybe we don't even need humans at that point to do that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. But just the idea that we could get medical care or connect with somebody at that distance is really, really something incredible. People could design really dangerous things without getting anywhere near them.
Yeah.
It would be really incredible. So, of course, humans will build this, even if it ends up being our own undoing. Nita Farahani, episode 810 of this show, she was concerned that AI-enabled humans essentially will widen the gap between the haves and the have-nots to a degree that humanity has never seen. And I think, imagine you can afford to get an AI-enabled brain implant for your kids. I can do the same, but other people can't. Where I grew up near in Detroit, the difference in capabilities would probably be like an office worker who has a computer with internet versus an office worker who doesn't have lights or electricity, or it could even be a greater gap than that.
Yeah, I think that we are getting close to a point in history when it will be more and more likely that economic differences will get translated into real biological differences, which previously in history was true to some extent, like the rich had better food, so they grew taller, then, and they had other advantages, but basically they were still the same human beings. But the danger one of the dangers we are facing now with the new technology is that if we don't make sure that everybody benefits, then we might see the greatest inequality ever emerging because of these new technologies. This is certainly a very, very big danger.
Algorithms being able to tell our sexual orientation. This was something you mentioned. I can't remember where. I think it might have also been on 60 Minutes, but it's like at first, when you're talking about this, it sounds like a fun party game, and then you realize that it's going to end up with a bunch of people getting murdered by an authoritarian government. Take us through this, because I think a lot of things with algorithms start with, this is going to be so convenient, and they end with, wow, I did not see that coming.
Yeah, I think about my own life. So I came out as gay when I was only 21. And I often think about my life when I was, I don't know, 14 or 15. Now, it should have been obvious to me when I was 15 that I was gay. Because looking back, I was far more interested in guys than in girls, even back then. But I didn't realize it. I grew up in a very homophobic society, so you had a lot of kind of self-repression. And even though the signs are there, you repress them. You don't know. And this is something very, very human. There are many things we don't know about ourselves. Sometimes we don't know about ourselves the most important things in life. But an algorithm could have told me or could have discovered without telling me that I was gay when I was 15 very easily. You know, there are so many ways to do it. One way, which is today technically possible, is simply by tracking eye movements. That, you know, I don't know, I'm walking down the beach and there is a sexy guy and a sexy girl. Where do my eyes go? And where do they linger? This is something which is, you know, usually it's not even under your control. And today, a computer can track your eye movements and can know this even before you know it about yourself. So, you know, in some scenarios, it could be used in a good way to help people understand themselves and come to terms with themselves and so forth. But there are also quite disturbing usages for this kind of technology. One thing, for instance, is corporations using it to manipulate us. So, for instance, I don't know, like Coca-Cola discovering when I'm 15 that I'm gay before I know it about myself, and deciding which commercials to show me. Like they'll show me the commercial with the sexy guy and not with the sexy girl. But there are much, of course, worse scenarios. Like Uganda recently legislated a law which inflicts the death penalty on homosexuality. So what would the Ugandan government or the Iranian government or the Russian government do with algorithms that are able to detect people's sexual orientation? This is a frightening scenario, which could become real quite quickly. And I think more broadly, what we are looking at is the possibility of building the worst totalitarian regimes in human history. Because if you look at the 20th century, at regimes like Nazi Germany or the Soviet Union, they wanted to know everything about their citizens. They wanted to follow everybody all the time, but they couldn't because the technology was not there. You know, in the Soviet Union, you have 200 million citizens, more or less. You don't have 200 million KGB agents that can follow each and every person 24 hours a day. And even if you do, you know, in the days of Stalin or Brezhnev, so a KGB agent that follows you at the end of the day writes a paper report about everything that you did and said and everybody you met and whatever. And then they send this paper report to Moscow. And every day, imagine that KGB headquarters gets 200 million paper reports. Nobody is able to read it and analyze it. Now it is becoming possible. You don't need human agents to follow people around. You have all these cameras and microphones and so forth. And you don't need human analysts to make sense of the data. You have AI. So the new totalitarian regimes of the 21st century, they could be much worse than the Soviet Union. They can actually follow everybody all the time. And for instance, discover things about you that you don't know about yourself, like your sexual orientation when you're a teenager.
What do you think the macro effect of this is going to be?
You know, the macro effect is that we have all these existential threats we need to deal with as humanity. It's the technological threat we've just been discussing at length, the rise of AI and biotechnology and all the implications. And we have the ecological threat. And instead of uniting to deal with these threats together, we are just creating another existential danger of the Third World War that seemed like an almost impossible scenario, say 10 years ago, but now is increasingly looking like a very likely eventuality. Even if we don't have a hot world war, a Third World War, If we don't unite to deal with AI on the one hand and the ecological crisis on the other, we can't solve these problems. Individual nations by themselves, they cannot stop climate change. We need some global agreement on it. And even more so with regard to regulating AI, countries that don't trust each other will not be able to regulate this disruptive technology. So we'll get into an arms race in AI, an arms race in biotechnology. And an arms race almost guarantees the worst outcome. Like every side, I don't know, you think about creating killer robots, weapons that are autonomous and can decide by themselves who to shoot and who to kill. This is obviously a very, very dangerous technology. Every country would say, we don't want to do it. It's obvious that this is a very dangerous step, but we cannot allow ourselves to remain behind. We can't trust the Russians, the Israelis, the Chinese, whoever, not to do it first. So we must do it before them. And the other side would say the same thing. And then you'll have an arms race. Who is going to develop first the most effective and lethal killer robots? And then everybody knows it's a bad idea, and still everybody does it. That's the logic of an arms race. And the only way to stop it is through cooperation. But when you have Putin invading Ukraine, and it when again becomes a norm in the international system that one country just tries to destroy its neighbors because it can, then trust collapses. And there is no way that we can stop the arms race or reach some agreement on regulating dangerous technologies.
Thanks for checking out this entire episode of The Jordan Harbinger Show. If you're interested in exploring this topic further, check out The Jordan Harbinger Show podcast feed. There, we dive even deeper on this and many other topics. In the audio podcast, I also close open loops, cover things discussed off camera, off air, and give some parting lessons from our guest. You can find The Jordan Harbinger Show in Apple Podcasts, Spotify, any podcast app, or at jordanharbinger.com. And also, if you found this episode useful, please share it with those you care about. Last but not least, like, comment, and subscribe.
My thanks to Jordan Harbinger for allowing this show sample for Radio EcoShock listeners. Get the whole thing and a lot more at his website, www.jordanharbinger.com. His full show with Harari is totally worth your time. I've just begun to explore Jordan's many interviews with famous world experts. Is AI more important than climate change? That seems unlikely. While over 2 billion humans sweat through never-before-seen long-lasting heat, climate change does not need more years to arrive. It is here now, and it needs concerted world action yesterday. Will artificial intelligence destroy humanity in 6 months? No one is really saying that. But AI is learning at a rate thousands of times faster than humans. In fact, artificial intelligence already knows more than any one of us and has more data than any institution. These experts worry AI may reach a tipping point as rapidly as the end of 2023, when its development cannot be seen by humans, understood by us, or controlled by us. Then it insinuates itself into every aspect of our lives and makes decisions and actions using logic we do not understand. At some point, it seems inevitable that AI will run our lives or decide to end some or all of us for its own purposes or for no reason at all. We must prevent that from happening. We must act somehow before that runaway point is reached. Meanwhile, can humanity navigate the polycrisis, the combination of severe threats already upon us, the mix of ongoing pandemic, climate disasters one after another, gross economic inequality, violence, and militarism? There's a long list of urgent threats. Fighting off domination by artificial intelligence is urgent, but not alone. You will find a small, carefully selected list of YouTube chats and presentations on AI in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.org. You don't need to sign up. There is no advertising or pop-ups. Just listen right there or download exactly what you want. Ecoshock.org. I'm Alex Smith. Thank you for listening and caring about our world.
In the atmosphere.
You're listening to KBOO Portland.
So, how much is that golden doodle or adorable Frenchie in the window? Probably a lot, especially in terms of suffering for its parents, who in many cases are living lives of misery in a puppy mill. On the next episode of Voices for the Animals, we'll be talking with Robert Hensley, senior counsel for the ASPCA, about their push to pass Goldie's Act, a bill now in Congress that would ensure better conditions and oversight for the hundreds of thousands of dogs now suffering at the hands of large-scale dog breeders.
The dog that Goldie's Act is named for was one of the dogs that lived in squalor and tragically was allowed to starved to death over several months while USDA inspectors observed her deteriorating condition, but did nothing to help her.
That's on the next Voices for the Animals, Friday, July.